Hello, and welcome to Tolerable Risk, the podcast for NGO, nonprofit, and charity professionals who manage risk. I'm your host, Sabrina Siegel. Today, we're going to talk to Anthony Pusatori. Anthony is an international humanitarian and development specialist with 12 years of experience in the Middle East. He is founder and managing director of Seven Pillars Social Impact Consulting and a U.S. Army Special Operations veteran. He has worked with organizations such as ACTED, the International Rescue Committee, and the Norwegian Refugee Council, supporting donors such as UNHCR, WFP, USAID, GIZ, and FCDO, among others. His focus has been the Syrian refugee crisis, leading innovation projects and developing strategy. He is a graduate from the University of Colorado and holds master's degrees from Columbia University and the University of North Carolina. Thank you so much, Tony, for coming on Tolerable Risk today. I'm super excited to have you on because the topic we're going to talk about today is really, really interesting and near and dear to my heart. We're going to be talking about innovation in the third sector, particularly from the implementing partner point of view, and how program designers and implementing partners need not fear innovation, need not fear risk, but rather embrace it and take a look at where those possible opportunities could lie when they are innovating new and creative solutions. But before we get into that topic today, can you just tell our listeners who may not be familiar with you and your background a little bit more about yourself? How'd you get into the third sector? And what are you working on now?
Of course. Thank you for having me, first of all. So I guess I am someone who was surprised to find themselves working in this sector, working in the humanitarian and development field. My career, I would say, started in the military. I was in the active duty in the U.S. Army for about 4 years and got out in 2012, went back and got my master's degree, and then came to the Middle East, where I've been for the past decade plus. In that time, I've worked mainly in Jordan and mainly focused on the Syrian refugee crisis. I've been working for a variety of different organizations, humanitarian and development. The highlights of my career have been working with the Ministry of Planning and International Cooperation here in Jordan on the rollout of the Jordan Compact, which was a significant agreement back in 2016. And then between 2018 and 2020, working with a dedicated research, learning, and innovation program around employment for Syrian refugees. I'm now the managing director of Seven Pillars Social Impact Consulting. It's an organization located here in the Middle East, and our goal is to support organizations to increase their impact in the work that they do, either through providing monitoring and evaluation support, assisting with research, or providing subject matter expertise.
What an interesting background, Tony. You've gone through such a wide variety of things in your career and in your life. Today, I want to focus on innovation and talk a little bit about how you've seen innovation in the programs and projects that you've worked on.
When people hear the word innovation, what do they get wrong? What are they mistakenly thinking about it, or what are their mistaken expectations when they hear the word innovation?
My experience in this sector has been very specific, so maybe that's kind of a good caveat to start with. My experience has been mainly here in Jordan and really focused on refugee issues and the Syrian refugee crisis in particular. It's a crisis that has been going on since basically 2012, so past 10 years of this protracted crisis. And in that time, I've been working on various different issues related to refugee protection, employment, shelter, water and sanitation. And a lot of the time, the solutions that we've come up with are, maybe you can say, are adequate for a certain time, but not adequate across all times. We've gotten in the habit of trying to apply the same solutions over and over again when the context is completely changing year by year. And so a lot of the solutions that we've tried to apply, or that we applied back in 2012 or 2013, are still being funded and still being implemented in the field today, but with very little impact. And I think the data and the research that we can see coming out of some of these approaches shows that a huge amount of money is going into some of these, let's say, traditional approaches to refugee support, but not very much is being gained as a result, or it's not demonstrating very much impact.
Why is that happening? We hear so much about donors being risk averse, right? And if a donor is funding something that is not making the impact, why are they still funding it? What's the disconnect? Why are we still in this endless cycle of funding projects, programs, activities that are not making an impact, as you say?
I think there are a couple of reasons, but one is, I guess, the reason why the third sector is the third sector, why it's so much different than the private sector. And I think for us, it's the fact that we deliver programs or products or services to what we call beneficiaries, where at the same time, we're not necessarily answerable to those beneficiaries. We're not necessarily answerable to the people that we're delivering for. We're answerable to donors. And so it sets up this strange dynamic in which you're producing services or producing a program or something for a group of people. And whether that activity, that service, that product, whether it's judged a success or failure is not really up to the person who's the end user. It's judged by the person providing the money, the fund. And I think it's this disconnect in that kind of dynamic where the people getting the service aren't necessarily the ones deciding whether it's successful or not successful. And the second point is that there is a big disconnect between funders and what happens in the field. I would say implementing partners or NGOs or third sector partners that are implementing activities that are funded by donors, they have the expertise, the on the ground knowledge of what works and what doesn't work. And that has to be communicated upward from the field level experience up to donors. And there is a delay. There is a lag in the way that information is communicated to donors. And so it's kind of inevitable that because there is that lag, donors will forever be a year, 2 years, 3 years behind is what's actually working on the ground.
Would you say that there's a lag in communication, or would you say that there's this dynamic between implementing partners and donors where maybe implementing partners are afraid to, I don't want to say tell the truth, but afraid to give the real information or the real picture for fear of upsetting a donor, and then donors aren't really asking for anything that might be disruptive mm-hmm. to their program design, and therefore it's this weird kind of dance that donors and implementing partners do together, where it's like, well, you want to see this move? Okay, I'll do this move. I'm just mm-hmm. really trying to understand, because I've seen it to myself when I was out in the field. But if we are going to be talking about innovation today, why are we still funding things that are not working before we even get to innovation? How is this mm-hmm. happening?
I think a lot of it comes down to structures that have been put into place. We've tried to minimize risk as much as possible in humanitarian or development work, where everything is risky. A lot of things are unpredictable and they're constantly changing. And I think we've set up these systems, internal donor systems, grant systems, accounting and finance systems, that try to minimize away risks. And a lot of that is, as you said, donors develop, say, long-term strategies and try to think long-term about everything that needs to happen on a big scale. And that gets translated down to implementing partners or INGOs or NGOs that implement these activities. And I think, yeah, there is this pressure where you're made to understand that a donor organization has this very detailed, very well thought out strategy, and we need to stick to that strategy. And we're kind of afraid to upset or rock the boat in a way, because we know that donor funding is dependent on implementing that strategy. And so when it comes around that you can say the problem that we're trying to solve is shifting or changing, and we need to develop some sort of dynamic response to it, or we need to develop more innovatively, because the structure has been created and this intricate long-term strategy is guiding everything, it's very difficult to fit innovation into it or to make changes on the ground as needed.
I think that's a great point. And I think this takes us very nicely into the conversation about innovation, because innovation a lot of times is also associated with a concept of maybe disruption, right? I mean, we're kind of introducing something that's going to change the way that we do things. We're going to innovate and come up with a new and different solution. And I think what you were saying, current structures that we have in the third sector, particularly on the implementing side, maybe are not conducive to innovation. So when you have seen organizations or individuals trying to introduce innovation into these structures that we have, and maybe you've tried to do it yourself, what has been embraced and what has been rejected?
So innovation as a concept is always embraced. the idea of doing something new, exploiting a new opportunity, addressing a problem that hadn't been addressed before, or the promise of doing something better or in a new way, a new, more efficient or effective way, that's always embraced. The headline of innovation is always embraced. And certain aspects of innovation are also embraced. So for example, co-creation sessions when developing program proposals or requests for proposals for donors, brainstorming sessions or other kinds of innovation tools are very much embraced. Human-centered design, for example, is very much embraced. Sort of these innovative approaches to program design, those are all very well supported and always referenced and used. I think what's not supported is the idea of failure and the ability to adapt to failure. So even now, I think, and there's a lot of reasons for this. If you're looking at truly implementing an innovative activity, there has to be a high tolerance for the risk of failure. And I think there aren't very many organizations, especially small organizations that have few resources and donors who have trouble accepting failure or explaining failure. It's very difficult to talk about failure or to think about how we can program that would adapt to failure when it does happen. I think those are the things that are rejected. Failure is a necessary part of innovation. And this idea that you have to innovate at the beginning of a program, get it all out of the way first, and then implement is kind of backwards. And I think the true way forward, or the way that real innovation is done, is by experimentation, failure, and adaptation, where you arrive at a new solution at the end of a program, say, rather than at the beginning. And I think that's the part that most people are less supportive of, or maybe not less supportive, but they have not yet adapted or created the systems to support.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of times donors come to the innovation conversation with a mix of excitement, yeah, we're going to disrupt. But then when the rubber actually meets the road, they sort of retreat to this posture of fear, of risk, right? I mean, and they want to, instead of embracing opportunity, which is the flip side of risk from the threat side, they really just say we need to mitigate and manage and eliminate risk, which is sort of a killer for innovation. Would you say?
Definitely. There are traditional approaches to activities that are less risky, especially in the humanitarian sector, where we're talking about things like cash distributions, for example. These are very well researched. These are very well, I guess, de-risked activities. There's kind of a traditional approach to it. There are guidelines. There are SOPs. There's a lot of fundamentals that you can rely on in some of these traditional approaches. But at the same time, there are wide areas that have not yet really been explored. And for example, one of those would be financial inclusion. It involves a lot of things that make third sector organizations uncomfortable, especially where risk is a major part of it. Any kind of activity that's focusing on providing credit or loans or insurance products or microfinance products for that matter, there is a certain level of risk that you have to be able to accept and program around. But I think it's that kind of aversion to risk in all forms that keeps us from looking at some of these areas that have potential for great impact, like financial inclusion or financial literacy, but are necessarily more risky than traditional approaches. And so we end up not looking at those sectors really at all.
I read a lot of third sector press and things that are going on. And you read a lot about organizations, usually the larger ones, larger funders, larger INGOs that are developing these sort of innovation hubs, right? And they're putting resources towards them. Everyone's got an innovation director, an innovation office, an innovation hub somewhere, you know, in Berlin or something like that, right? If you're a small to medium-sized organization, do you need to have an innovation hub, or can you just integrate innovation into how you do your work? Can you talk a little bit about that? If you're a more simple, small, low to no resourced organization, how can you just work it into your operations?
So I worked for one of those innovation hubs. When I was at the International Rescue Committee, I worked at the Airbell Center, which is IRC's innovation hub. And it was really interesting because it's kind of a necessity for large international NGOs, for them to do anything innovative. The Airbell Center had its own programs, had its own staff, it had its own donors. And so in a lot of ways, it was a completely separate organization from IRC proper, which was really interesting because it's almost like it's creating its own small NGO within the larger NGO. And one that I guess the intention is that it can move faster, be more dynamic, be a little bit more risk-taking, and that it can kind of be confined to one small area of the organization. It's useful because I think they try and get the best of both worlds. Any risk that the organization takes on, it can be kind of fenced off in that small innovation hub. But then at the same time, if the innovation hub needs support, they can also always reach out to the larger organization for technical support on a particular subject, finance support, HR support, all of these things. So it's kind of the best of both worlds. But for small and medium-sized organizations or low-resourced organizations, they definitely don't have that ability. And I don't think they need it. I think the bigger organizations need to create those because they are large, because they cannot quickly. And so if you're a small organization, you're already in a position where you're able to respond more dynamically, you're able to create new interventions, you're able to redirect strategy and resources much more quickly. So I think you're already in a better position just by being a smaller organization. In a lot of ways, I think these hubs that larger NGOs or international NGOs have created, they're trying to recreate that structure of a small, under-resourced organization. And so I think you're already there. And I think a lot of the things that they're trying to create are some of those smaller teams, smaller numbers of grants to manage, more direct relationship with funders that small organizations have already. And I think those are the things to kind of emphasize on, not necessarily that these bigger organizations have more resources and more staff and more technical knowledge.
I think that's such an interesting way of looking at it. So in the innovation world, maybe smaller is better, right? Maybe not necessarily having all those hubs. I think it was interesting how you were saying that these larger organizations are almost creating a mini version of themselves. So they have that benefit of flexibility, of being agile, being able to move quickly and respond quickly and pivot and adapt and then accelerate, which is what smaller organizations with the right funders have the ability to do already. So smaller is not necessarily worse than innovation. That's great. So, Tony, if you were going to advise a small to medium-sized organization, a low-resourced, no-resourced, but enthusiastic in this area about innovation, and now we're not necessarily just talking about humanitarian organizations. Maybe we're talking about the local charity down the road that is working with animals or with elderly people or is working on climate change, something like that. How would you advise them to start thinking about and working innovation into their ways of working?
I think there's a lot of room for organizations to be innovative if they want to be. And I think one of the big things that they can do is start looking at where they want to get funding from. Certain organizations are less accepting of risk and innovation than others. So for example, if you're looking at funding from USAID or GIZ or AFD for that matter, big bilateral funders. These are funders that are relying on public funds. These are organizations that use government money to apply to humanitarian or development projects. And because it's public funding, there is a certain aversion to risk. You don't want to be careless with public resources or taxpayer money. And so I would say, if you want to be innovative, there are much better sources of funding to pursue. And there's a lot of opportunities from private sector foundations or institutional funds that will allow for a lot more innovation and a lot more risk-taking. Organizations that will allow you to fail, or that will allow you to design programs where failure is a part of the implementation or the design of the activity. And so I think the biggest thing is to understand who you're getting your support from, who you're partnering with, and who you're getting funding from, and how that funding can kind of shape or constrain innovation.
That's such a great answer, Tony, and especially because it aligns really well with a previous episode of Tolerable Risk that you can find anywhere you get your podcasts, where we were talking about grants from a donor perspective. And the guest I had on that show, Defrim Deday, was talking about how exactly that, you know, your large institutional donors, your government donors are going to have a much lower risk appetite and risk profile than some private foundations, family foundations, individual donors who may be more inclined to take a higher risk because they see the opportunity as opposed to a threat, and they're more willing to absorb some failure. And so if you have a really genuinely innovative idea, trying to seek funding from some of those organizations to get a proof of concept, and then once you have that, going to the more established funders to then scale whatever your innovation is, maybe an interesting way to do it. But if you are trying to work this into your organization, what would you say would be the top three areas of risk when it comes to innovation?
Top three areas of risk. It's an interesting question.
Maybe it could simply be that the risk depends on the type of innovation that you're doing, the thematic area that you're working in. That could be one answer, right? But if someone is saying, I want to jump in, I want to be innovative, what are some red flags, though, that they should be looking out for along their innovation journey?
There's definitely risk associated with innovation, and it's not just necessarily the positive risk that we've talked about so far. There is definitely negative risk, and I think you have to control for that. I think one of the things you have to be as an organization is upfront about how you're pursuing these innovative opportunities, because innovation doesn't necessarily mean just going out and doing it whatever you want. It means you have to be a little bit more responsible, and you have to be able to think out and think through the ways you're going to approach some of these things. So for example, if you're trying a set of different interventions to solve a particular problem, maybe there's a way to structure it as a randomized control trial, or that there's a way to organize the way that you're delivering the activity so that you can get real usable data that can point to where you're failing and where you're succeeding. I think if you're communicating upfront that you have a well thought out approach to innovation, that you have a structure in place that will allow you to learn and that you'll be collecting the right amount of data and the right kind of data to point you in the right direction of where success is and where failure is, I think that's one way to start. The other way is also be very clear with everybody, all the stakeholders on your project or your program, in how your organization is approaching innovation and approaching risk. Nobody wants to be caught off guard in terms of the potential for failure. But if you're communicating clearly that this is the potential for failure and these are our assumptions, if you're stating clearly about where your assumptions lie, what risks are attached to those assumptions, and what needs to be true to make those assumptions work, then I think you're in a stronger place. And I think communication is key to that. Communicating to the employees on your project or the people working on your project, implementing your activities, helping them understand that failure is not the end, but also communicating upward to organizations that you partner with or funding organizations that this is how you're going to approach innovation and this is how you're going to approach potential failure.
That's a really great point, talking about communicating with your team. So if you're an organization that really is saying, look, we want to start doing innovation, what would you say are some good skill sets for folks to be on that team? We had talked earlier, you got your MBA and you were saying how you wish you would have done it earlier, because a lot of these skills and knowledge that you learned through that program was really helpful for you in development. But a lot of times, and maybe not so much recently, but I know in the recent past, folks with MBAs were not so interested in going into the third sector and were also kind of poo-pooed in the third sector, right? Oh, you know, Mr. MBA businessman out for a profit, what are you doing here in the charity sector? That has been a real response that I have heard from folks in organizations I've worked in. So, you know, if you are advising small to medium-sized organizations, again, low to no resource, but they have a little bit of resourcing, what is the good skill set blend to really get innovation going?
I don't know if there's a particular profile for innovation, but I would say that having a diversity of different perspectives is key. I think a lot of times, and maybe this is one of the specific ways that organizations kind of run themselves into these areas where they're unable to innovate anymore. I think when we're looking at hiring people onto a project, we tend to gravitate toward the people that we understand or the profiles of people that are most like ourselves. And I think a lot of times we end up hiring into one organization members from a different organization that's very similar to ours. And so we fail to look for different profiles. And so we end up losing out a lot on different perspectives or different approaches. Humanitarian workers will move from one organization to the next, and kind of there's very little maybe room for differing opinions or different experiences. Maybe that's one way that we can encourage more innovation in an organization. If you have a greater diversity of viewpoints, a greater diversity of backgrounds, a greater diversity of experiences, I think that always helps in creating an environment where you can innovate or think differently. And maybe the second way is there has to be systems set up to support or encourage innovation. And there has to be a sense of psychological safety where I know that I can suggest ideas, that I can come up with new ideas, that I'm not going to be looked down on or looked at differently because of a different perspective. There's a lot of room within the organization itself and within a team to create psychological safety for the members of that team so that they feel supported when putting different ideas or different viewpoints on the table. And also, I think our HR systems and the systems that we use for evaluating employees, tracking success over time are sometimes not advantageous to innovation. A lot of times we're maybe unconsciously, and this is especially the case in bigger organizations, success is promoted and success is the thing that the differentiating factor. It's difficult for teams to reward things other than success, I would say. And so if you're looking at doing innovation and you're thinking necessarily that you have to fail in order to find the next big solution, you're going to put yourself in a difficult position if you're looking to advance within an organization that doesn't reward that.
Those are excellent answers. And I love the real focus on diversity and inclusion. And these are not just areas of thought that are kind of pigeonholed into HR. Like you're saying, if you want an organization to be strong in the area of innovation, we have to have diversity of thought. We have to have diversity around the table. And you have to have an environment where people feel safe enough to speak up and speak out, not just about the bad things or things that are happening, but new solutions, different solutions. That's where innovation comes from. So I think those are great answers. How would you recommend for somebody to build a business case around innovation? Let's say you're a staff member in a small to medium-sized organization, and you really think that innovating around a particular area, finding a different solution, is going to be the way to go for the organization. But maybe their leadership, their management, their board has a more conservative point of view on risk. So again, going back to what is risk, right? Risk is the effect of uncertainty on objectives. Risk is composed of two things, threats and opportunities. So if the organization is really in more of the operating out of fear, seeing risk as only a threat and not an opportunity, what is a good way to communicate that innovation can also be an opportunity and that it's not a threat and that's not negative? How do you build a business case for innovation in a third sector organization?
It's very difficult, I would say, to kind of turn an organization in a new direction. And I think there are a lot of factors that you have to take into account because no organization operates by itself. It operates in a complex environment where it has competitors, it has organizations the left and right of it that it's in a sense competing for funding dollars against. And so it operates in this framework of, you know, you don't want to lose out and you don't want to be left behind. It also operates in a context where if upwards, it has to influence funders that are providing funding for different sectors as well. A business case is a good way of thinking about it because it's something that I think organizations in our sector don't do enough of. And I think part of a good business case is the cost-benefit analysis and maybe even a break-even analysis. So I think one of the things that organizations have a tendency to look for, maybe they focus on too much, is the negative side. What are the potential downsides? What are the potential risks? What are the potential negatives that we have in terms of financing, in terms of protection, maybe protection issues of the beneficiaries that we serve, reputational risks, or, you know, strategic risk in terms of if we go down this path, are we putting ourselves in a position where we can't be competitive anymore? I think there's a tendency to look only at the negatives. And a good business case or a good argument if trying to change strategy should be focusing on the upside risks as well. It should be focusing on what will happen if we succeed. What are the potential improvements or gains in efficiency that we could have by doing this activity this way or operating in this manner? What are the potential impact for the people that we serve? What we could gain in terms of opening up a new sector or demonstrating a new approach that other organizations could then use as well. I think we don't look at the positives enough, but then also I think it's connecting the two. It's looking at specifically what are the things that have to be true in order for us to get to success. And I think if you can break it down, stating what are our assumptions that are built into this? What have to exist in order for us to get from point A to point B. And if you can break apart that seemingly insurmountable challenge into its component parts and analyze each by saying, what has to exist, what has to change, what has to improve in order for our overall intervention to succeed, then it becomes much more attainable. It becomes something that's just a series of assumptions that have to be tested. And I think that's a strategy or an approach that organizations can do to convince the board to go in a certain direction, convince a donor to go in a certain direction, or even to convince the staff of a project to go in a new direction.
I like that. So essentially what you're saying is you have to build a convincing case for the organization so that they feel that they can enable strategic value creation through effective risk taking. Would that be a good summary of that point?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's about looking at the positives and negatives and then thinking through exactly what has to happen or what has to be tested in specific order in order for us to arrive at a conclusion of whether something is realistic or not realistic.
You mentioned the board in that answer a little bit, and I want to specifically ask you, because it's one of the things that I try and do on the podcast on every episode for our trustees or board members who are listening, or if you are an aspiring trustee or board member of a third sector organization, we try and have a little section here to give you some tips and tricks for boards. How would you advise boards to more embrace the positive risk opportunity side of innovation and be a little less fearful? What are maybe some questions that boards can ask their organizational leadership and management, data that they can collect, surveys that they can do? What can a board member do to really communicate that innovation is important? And what can they do to support innovation in their organization?
In terms of the role of the board in smaller organizations, I think there's a lot to be said in how they play a much more important role in setting the organizational culture or helping the organization develop a culture that facilitates innovation. I think in our sector, we have a tendency to try and mitigate risk down to zero by creating ever more elaborate strategies, Gantt charts, action plans, risk mitigation tables, and risk registers. We have all of these tools to try and plan out in as much detail as possible what we're going to do, why we're going to do it, and what we hope to see in the end. But a lot of times, and I think even you've mentioned it on the podcast, is culture dominates in a lot of cases. And I think it's an important role for the board to play in emphasizing culture and not just strategy, and developing or helping foster a culture that is accepting of risk, that's accepting of innovation, and that's encouraging new approaches to implementation or intervention.
So again, effective risk taking, right? Not just taking risks, not just innovating for the sake of it, but having a plan around it and accepting that there may be failure, and that's part of innovation. So something that boards can really try and communicate to their organization so that solutions and more creative ways of working can be developed, again, through effective risk taking. So yeah, maybe that's something that they can, they can keep in mind. So innovation is a buzzword. We hear a lot of it, a lot of innovation talking about climate change, a lot of innovation talking about technology, high tech, low tech, no tech solutions for beneficiaries and whatnot. This is an ever-changing area. How do you stay on top of what's going on in the area of innovation? What are you reading right now? Are you taking any online classes? If folks are interested in learning more in a more structured way about innovation and innovation in the third sector in particular, what can you recommend for them to read or review or listen to, besides this podcast, of course? What's out there for them?
Of course. There are some really great resources. And I think in terms of learning more about innovation as a subject area or as a technical area that you can apply, IDEO is one of the best organizations out there. They provide a lot of free tools, but also a lot of training that help you think more innovatively, become a more innovative leader or project manager, courses on and guidance on how to facilitate innovation in a team, how to build psychological safety in an organization, kind of the nuts and bolts of innovation as innovation. IDEO and IDEO.org are two really good resources. I think in terms of the specific kind of innovation in the social impact sector or in the third sector, the Stanford Social Innovation Review is a great resource. It's a little more academic. It's looking at a little bit more specifically interventions that are being applied, that are being tested, that are being explored in humanitarian and development work. So everything from sustainable agriculture interventions to impact financing and impact investing. So it's a great resource, the Stanford Social Innovation Review. But then also, I think one of the great things that I learned from doing my MBA is a lot of the thinking, a lot of the resources that are out there for innovation in the private sector are just as applicable to the work that we do in the humanitarian world. And so the Harvard Business Review is a great resource as well for understanding, you know, how private sector companies are approaching risk, how they're approaching risk specific to innovation, how they're thinking about innovation with regard to product or program design, how it's implemented within the organization, how they create structures to facilitate risk or to foster risk taking and innovation within the organization. So I think there's a lot of resources just on the private sector side as well that shouldn't be discounted just because we are third sector.
Tony, is there anything that we didn't cover? Do you have any last parting words of wisdom for our listeners today on how implementing partners can really more embrace the positive sides of risk and opportunities for innovation?
Maybe only one point. So I think innovation, as you said before, has become a bit of a buzzword. And a lot of times we're labeling things as innovative just because we're not familiar with them. But there's a lot of things that have been tried over the course of the last half century of formalized humanitarian interventions. There is a deep literature that exists, and I think there's a lot of resources that people can rely on in thinking innovatively about new directions for their organization. So, for example, here in Jordan, financial inclusion and financial literacy is kind of a new frontier in the way we're approaching the refugee crisis. And it's very new for all of the organizations here, and a lot of times looked at as a very innovative approach to addressing the crisis. But if you look at other countries, South Africa, Zimbabwe, Kenya, especially, where they have very rich, very dynamic ecosystems of financial inclusion, you can see that a lot of the things that we're thinking are very innovative and very new have already been tried in other locations and present great use cases, great proofs of concept for us to try the same innovations in our areas. And so I think one of the things to be aware of is, though we have a tendency to think of ourselves as being very creative, and when we're doing something that nobody else around us is doing, we think we're being very innovative. But a lot of times we're doing things that have been tried in other places. And so I think it's important to be well-read, be very inquisitive about things that are going on outside your own small area of expertise, things that are going on outside of your own geographic location. It helps us be more innovative, but it also helps us be a little bit more realistic at the same time.
I love it. I love it. What do they say? Everything old is new again.
There's nothing new under the sun.
Nothing new under the sun. So if people are inquisitive, Tony, and they want to reach out to you and they want to chat with you more about your experience, or they have questions for you about innovation in the third sector, how can they get in touch with you?
I would encourage them to visit our website at 7pillarsimpact.com. It lays out everything that we're doing and has contact information where you can get in touch with me directly. And we're also very active on LinkedIn. So you can visit us at 7pillars on LinkedIn, and we can connect there.
Amazing. Awesome. Thank you so much for your time today talking about innovation. I think it's going to be a topic that we'll be talking about in the risk area for a long, long time. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
So that's our show for today. Please remember to like, subscribe, and follow us for all your third sector risk information. Thanks for listening to Tolerable Risk.